Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term medical plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term medical plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, this is Marion Bartoli.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carillo.
I'm Stan Wawrinka.
I'm Leighton Hewitt.
I'm Andy Murray.
This is Yannick Noah, and you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Tennis Podcast. Hello, Catherine. How are you doing?
Hello, David. I'm doing all right. How are you?
I'm all right. All right. I've just listened to your interview with Chris Evert. Blimey neck. You had an hour with the 18-time Grand Slam champion Chris Evert. How good's that?
It was pretty cool. Yeah. An hour-long therapy session for her and for me.
I got lost in it. I've just listened to it all over again. And I mean, I'd already listened to it once about a month ago. And it's something we've wanted to do for such a long time, to just properly focus on Chris Evert's career, because I don't feel in the years that I've covered the sport that we and in fact the media and the tennis world properly understands what this woman achieved in the sport, what she gave to the sport, what she's meant to people within the sport. It feels, I don't want to say she's been a forgotten champion, because she hasn't, but it certainly doesn't feel as though she's been sufficiently at the forefront of our minds. So Catherine, we were happy enough that Catherine got the interview. Matt's here. Hello, Matt. Matt has gone into the archives and just produced some preparation for that interview, which is why we're doing this today. Matt's research for Catherine's interview was so incredible that we thought we have to find a way to get this out there. And it's just been such a wonderful experience to learn about her career and her life, really.
Not only are we back on the podcast, David, having to replace Chris Evert, but we're having to replace Chris Evert talking about Chris Evert. I mean, talk about a tough challenge today that we've got ahead of us. But, you know, my notes are there.
So. your notes are worth it.
Just read them out, Matt. Page by page. They have got hyperlinks in, folks. When I saw the hyperlinked contents page for those notes, I knew we were in for a treat.
They're 19 pages long, Matt's notes on Chris Evert's career and stats. There's a stats page alone, which is just mind-boggling, and which, you know, in the interview that we heard a few days ago, we hear you relate some of those stats to her, Catherine, and even some of them she isn't aware of.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't had a 19-page document for every great tennis player in history from Matt. Yeah, pull your finger out, Matt. but I think stats-wise, Chris Evert probably has the best stats of any tennis legend, the best sort of most interesting varied list of incredible feats in stats form. And yeah, you alluded to it earlier, it does feel kind of weird to talk about or think about an 18-time Grand Slam champion that's still very much in all our consciousnesses, because, you know, she works with me on Eurosport. She's an ever-present on the ESPN team on US TV coverage. It's strange to think of somebody like that as potentially underappreciated. But when I looked through this 19-page document, I thought, we're not talking about Chris Evert enough.
Do you know, I just to say, I think one of the reasons for that as well, though, is because she isn't somebody who talks about herself. She doesn't talk about her own achievements in her commentary or as some other commentators do. There's that line she gives you, Catherine, where she asks you, does it sound conceited that I'm comparing myself in any way to Novak Djokovic? And immediate response is no, it doesn't. It would if I did, but you're Chris Evert. And I think that sometimes it does go a little bit unacknowledged just how great she was.
Yeah, and I was reflecting on that question of why it goes unacknowledged. Like, why is Chris Evert underappreciated? Because I think if you were living through the Chris Evert era, you would know why she was so important, because it strikes me that she was someone that was marketed in tennis for maybe one of the first times. She was someone who brought tennis into the mainstream. She got people watching. She bridged that gap between Billie Jean King, who, in Chris Evert's own words, made them celebrities, made them famous, got them recognition, and Martina Navratilova, who made people realize how good these women were athletically. And she was both those things, Chris Evert. And she's also got a legacy because she brought in the two-handed backhand. She's got an academy. So she's got all these reasons why we should be talking about her, but I can't really put my finger on why we've not talked about her quite so much. You know, those things point to the fact that we should be talking about her, and those are the reasons we are now. But why has it been on for a few years where she has been under the radar? I'm not sure I know the answer.
Yeah, if you compare her to Martina, say, and that's obviously an extremely obvious comparison to bring, I feel like we talk about Martina a lot more, and maybe that's because Martina is extremely political. She keeps herself in our consciousness with her political views. But I think, I mean, this all comes into the whole misunderstanding, I think, of Chris Evert as a person, which we'll, I'm sure, talk about in depth. But I think Chris Evert, in her own quiet way, is quite political. She's certainly unafraid. She's perhaps a bit more cautious about it and a bit less brazen about it than Martina, but she's not afraid to be herself and be political. I remember a couple of years ago, I was working with Five Live at Wimbledon. Have I already told this story on the pod?
Not to my knowledge.
I was working with Five Live. If everyone's tuned out, I apologise. Well, you're not hearing me apologise. Anyway, God, we're 7 minutes in and I'm already potentially raking through old material. Oh, well.
It's going to be good, folks.
A couple of years ago, I was working with Five Live at Wimbledon and it was Middle Sunday. And yet again, the order of play was released and it was two men's matches and one women's on centre court. And actually, the gender balance across the show courts was even worse than it had been in previous years. It's never once been balanced or in women's favour. But broadly, the trend was slight improvement over the years, but this felt like a big step back. And you know, the lazy excuse of market forces and golden era of men's tennis, et cetera, was trotted out. And I was really upset by it. I was really angered by it. I was really upset by how so many people were lazily accepting that market forces argument. I remember having a discussion with you about it, David, and he said, well, unfortunately, to get noticed, for that upset to be noticed, somebody of note has got to say it. And I just worked with Chris Evert for the first time at the French Open a couple of weeks before. And I had learned what a cool, gnarly, fearless lady she is and a great feminist, in my view, as well. And you said, go and try and find Chris Evert. Great. Yeah. Thanks, David. So off I went. And I loitered outside the ESPN makeup room for, I think, about an hour and a half. It wasn't cool. It wasn't hugely dignified. And eventually she came out and she greeted me warmly. And I said, I'm going to cut to the chase here. I don't think this is okay. I suspect you don't think it's okay either. Would you be prepared to say that for me? And she said, no, I don't think it's okay. bits, but she sort of rolled her eyes and said, but what's new? You know, this doesn't surprise me. What's new? And if I say something about it, it'll most likely go big or will be taken out of context. She basically didn't trust it to be taken the right way or reported responsibly. And I was going to, normal Catherine Whittaker behavior would have been to say, thanks for your time. It's been a pleasure waiting an hour and a half for this conversation. I understand your position. Have a great day. And I stopped myself for a moment. I had a rare moment of channeling my inner David Law. I took a deep breath and I said, I know this isn't surprising, but nothing's ever going to change unless, you know, we make it change. And then I thought, why are you telling Chris Evert this? She knows this. Shut up, Catherine. And I said, look, I will happily shout about this all day long, but no one will listen to me. They will listen to you. And she took a deep breath as well. And she said, OK, I'll do it. And she did it. And I think it made the airwaves.
Oh, yeah. Made the airwaves.
And the BBC website, and, you know, and people did take notice because Chris Evert said it.
And I seem to remember last year's Manic Monday schedule was more gender balanced than it had been in a long time.
Are you trying to say that my hour and a half
that's exactly spent what I'm saying.
waiting outside the ESPN makeup room every time the door opening, me thinking, seeing a peak of blonde hair, is that Chris Evert? No, okay. It was all worth it.
Yes.
Well, it all contributes to the conversation, doesn't it? And as you say, she gets heard because, and I also think she gets heard because she isn't somebody who's always talking. And her presence has grown, I think, in the last few years since she's been back on ESPN and back wanting to be part of the conversation, because she admitted to you as part of the interview you did, she went for a period of just being very relaxed when her boys were growing up, and she was quite happy to just stay out of the way, really, and just live a calm and more relaxing life. And in more recent years, she is wanted to be part of it all again.
And I think she talked a lot there and gave such an insight into sort of her process of finding a sense of self. And I think a lot of that involves finding your voice. And for her, that's been all tied up with this bizarre misconception that people have had of her over the years, this role that she had to play, which, as she said there in her own words, was a lie. But, you know, she was playing the role of the ice princess or the girl next door or whatever sort of incarnation of that trope it was on that day. It was sort of various versions of sweet girl plays great tennis, keeps her mouth shut, keeps her head down, because people don't like women to be outspoken and forthright and have opinions. Certainly not in the 70s and 80s, and perhaps slightly less so now, but it's still the case. You know, Martina was able to circumvent that to a certain extent, but that's because nobody wanted to put her in that box. Everybody wanted to shove her into a completely different, pretty unpleasant box, which sort of was mostly, you know, negative, but had, I suppose, the unintended consequence of liberating her to be outspoken. But that wasn't the case for Chrissy. And that must have been hard because she so clearly has a lot to say. Yeah. And yeah, she's finding a way to say it now. But all those years when she couldn't, when she didn't have a voice and felt like she couldn't speak and be herself and had to conform to what people expected her to be, that must have been very oppressive.
Mm. I think if we go back to the beginning of her life and her upbringing a little, just to sort of give some context, which she gave in the interview as well, but this from Larry Schwartz from the ESPN archives. He's written, she was born in December the 21st, 1954, in Fort Lauderdale, raised on the clay of that city's tennis courts where her father, Jimmy, was a teaching pro. When she was around five, her dad began giving her lessons. And while she was still under 5 feet tall in 1969, she was mentioned in Sports Illustrated's Faces in the Crowd for being ranked number one nationally in girls 14 and under tennis. So little thoughts of what we were talking about with Jennifer Capriati last week during Roland Garros, and maybe not quite as on the cover, but there were the similar very, very early results. She was reaching the semifinals of the US Open before she officially turned pro. And she said, "I was very, very shy as a younger girl, just petrified of people, and tennis helped give me an identity and made me feel like somebody." So really, I think that that's one of the things that comes across loud and clear in all the reading and the interview as well, is that by becoming a tennis player that young and being that channeled into the sport, trying to have both that and what anybody would call a normal upbringing, if such a thing exists, or having a discovery of yourself as a human being outside of the tennis court is nigh on impossible, it sounds, if you're at that sort of sharp end of the sport.
Yeah, I think this is probably where Martina Navratilova is such a massive outlier, because her pursuit of tennis forced her to grow up in a way. She had to abandon her home country. She had to learn a new language. She had to go and live in a different society. She had to figure out who she was to pursue tennis. Whereas it sounds to me like for Chris Evert, pursuing tennis in a way kind of suppressed that growth and that development of her as a person, and what brought her success on the court maybe caused her problems in later life because she wasn't able to kind of develop. So I think that's more the norm. I think Martina Navratilova's story is the unusual one, and there are probably lots of people out there like Chris Evert whose pursuit of tennis stagnates the rest of their life in a way, and it can be quite challenging to deal with that while you're playing, but also when you've finished. You've got a lot of figuring out to do, it sounded like she had.
Yeah, she in an interview with Sports Illustrated a while back, she was asked about her parents and the parenting she experienced, and she was asked, oh, a pretty bold question, really. Do you think your parents did it right? And she said, they did it right to produce a champion. I don't know if they did it right to develop a person. And I don't think she said that with any, or I don't get the impression, having spoken to her, that she would have said that with any resentment of, oh, I wish they'd done it differently. You know, she's just very aware of that trade-off. And goodness me, studying some of the stories that we've been able to study over the past week, that trade-off is something that just keeps coming up, isn't it? Keeps coming up with so many of the human stories in tennis.
Mm. Her 18th birthday in 1972 is around about when she turned pro. She won her first two Grand Slams, the French Open and Wimbledon, in 74. At the same time, she was engaged for a while to Jimmy Connors, and that was creating a lot of headlines. It says here in this piece in the ESPN archives that the relationship became strained, and they called off the wedding that they'd had planned. I found it really fascinating when she was talking to you and volunteered that her relationship with John Lloyd, her meeting John Lloyd, became a factor in that 1978 Wimbledon.
Yeah, that was cheeky. She knew she was catching me off guard there. And she really did. Every time I've listened to that interview back, I've been annoyed that I didn't follow up that whole rich theme of conversation by putting to her the question that Mary Carrillo put to Simona Halep in her pre-French Open press conference last year, which is, are you too happy? Is there such a thing as being too happy to be at the sharp end of tennis and to be winning major titles. I don't want to put words in Chris Evert's mouth because I didn't ask that question. I'm annoyed about it. But certainly I got the impression that that year at Wimbledon, from what she was saying, the answer then was she was too happy on that particular occasion. And yeah, I loved her honesty about that. And subsequently reading about, I mean, she's been incredibly open about all the major relationships in her life, hasn't she? You found an interview in Elle magazine, David, from about 9 years ago, I think, 2011.
Yeah, I'm a regular reader.
I love the idea of David going through the Elle magazine archives during lockdown. I woke up this morning to
a link from David to Elle magazine. Yeah, she talked about the breakdown of her three marriages, about the successes within them as well. But so frankly and so interestingly, and relating that to her struggle for a sense of self and struggle for validation. She was looking for validation throughout her life in a man, in another person. And I mean, yeah, she talks about going through the therapy process, and she seems to be a fantastic advert for therapy to me, because it's a level of self-reflection which is pretty rare, I think, in tennis players. It tends to improve with retirement and time, but still I think she's leaps and bounds ahead of most of them in the self-reflection stakes.
And actually there's a moment in your interview where you say, do you have any regrets? And there's a pause where she's trying to establish whether you mean any regrets in life or in my career. Because yeah. No, in my career, I feel absolutely, you know, the gist is, I mean, look, I did all right in my career. And look, she speaks with such warmth about parenthood and how much she wouldn't change that for anything. And that was the best moment in her life. But yeah, it seems that here she is now in her 60s, and the other one she kept saying to you was, I'm really honest now, I'm in my 60s, and because I can be, because I understand now where life is and what I must have gone through in order to be what I am now. And yeah, it's resulted in one of the most decorated sporting careers in history. And she did it throughout an era with records that just don't seem real when you start to go through them. And I mentioned how there was that period where she was together with Jimmy Connors and then she met John Lloyd, but we're missing out the fact that she spent basically the next 5 year period as world number one. She was what was the unbeaten run that she had on clay? I mean, it was 120 odd matches.
Yeah, which was another great moment in the interview when you put all the stats to her and she said, how about 125 matches winning on clay? That's a pretty good one.
Yeah, I felt like saying, it wasn't an exhaustive list, Chrissy.
And that was from August 1973 to May 1979, 125 match winning streak. Just incredible. Only 8 of those matches were 3 sets. So many of them straight sets. You put in the interview how many were 6 love sets. Just
she liked that, didn't she, Matt?
She did like that.
Yeah,
how many,
well done.
How many was it?
71 of the 258 sets, which works out as 28%.
Which is absurd.
Which is ridiculous.
Of 6 loves. And Tracy Austin eventually ended the run.
Mm. And Chris Evert, as we've talked about, was kind of the first teenage star, I suppose, in the professional game. But people, I think, would think of Tracy Austin as being the first. So there's an interesting sort of parallel between those two careers and how Evert obviously went on to have a much more successful career. But Tracy Austin at that time, people maybe thought was going to be the next Chris Evert.
She has the highest win percentage in the Open era, and that is a record that still stands. She retired in 1989, and that record, I believe, across men's and women's, is that right, mm-hmm. Matt? It still stands.
Right. Yeah, it is 90%, 1,309 wins, 146 losses. And of those 146 losses, 43 of them were against one player, Martina Navratilova. So Martina accounted for about 30% of her career losses. So take Martina away.
Oh, my goodness.
Golly.
this is where I feel like we, as a media and people within the sport, have just not got this right over the years, that when these staggering records being accumulated by Nadal, Federer and Djokovic and Serena Williams have been achieved, you never hear, and by the way, Chris Evert did this. You never hear that. And that bothers me, because the one that was always getting quoted was Federer's record of 23 consecutive semi-final appearances at Grand Slams, which is breathtaking. I'm not trying to suggest that it isn't, but it still isn't what Chris Evert managed to achieve, who reached 34 Grand Slam singles finals in total, and 52 semi-finals. I mean, she only played in 56 Grand Slams altogether, and she reached 52 semi-finals. There's only four events that she didn't manage to get to the semis.
I only discovered that stat this year. I remember it was during the Australian Open, and I don't know why I was looking at Chris Evert's stats, but I was, and I came across it, and I sort of triple, quadruple checked it, because I thought that cannot be true. But
I did
it is.
The same, because I thought, well, if that were true, we'd all be talking about it all the time. But unless it's the specific record or stat that a person of prominence is chasing, you don't hear about it. Margaret Court is being talked about all the time, because that one record is what Serena Williams is chasing. And I understand why that is. And I also realise that we are completely guilty of that. But it is wonky, isn't it? It's not quite right. It's because arguably a lot of those records that we've read out for Chris Evert, or when you drill down into them, as significant, if not possibly more so, than those 24 Grand Slam titles. Certainly worthy of being mentioned as much.
And I think that was a very important point Chris Evert made in the interview, when she talks about how GOAT discussion revolves purely basically around Grand Slams, and how when you look at Chris Evert's career, you see how reductive that is, because there's so much more to it. She, along with Martina and Billie Jean, she built the WTA Tour, and everything that went into that was obviously going to have an impact on her Grand Slam total. And she's got so many other records besides the Grand Slams, which need to come into a conversation when you're talking about greatest of all time, best of all time, whatever you want to say.
And they built that tour, obviously, sort of the charge was led by Billie Jean King, but the mantle very much picked up by Chrissy and Martina. They built that tour because they felt a sense of responsibility to do that. And David, I think you found an interview that they both did together on the BT Sport coverage of the tour finals in Singapore a few years ago, where they were both out there. And they were talking about just that, building what was then the Virginia Slims Tour, and going to events week in, week out, and knowing that if they didn't go to them, those events lost out so much in terms of coverage and prominence, and
deciding their schedule together so that they covered as many events between them, not going to the same ones, but just sustaining those tournaments with their star power.
Exactly. And although there was no desire from Chrissy in that interview, I felt, to throw current players under the bus or to disparage them in any way, I did get the sense that while she wasn't looking to be critical of it, she would probably agree that that sense of responsibility is not really there now. It's very much a more individualistic pursuit at the top of tennis. And she would say, and did say, well, we had Billie Jean King as our mentor, and that changes everything. You know, what better role model could you possibly have? But Billie Jean King is still out there as a mentor. She's still as vocal as she ever was. She is still available to mentor these young players, and that should be being utilised. Just because she's a few years older than she was back when she was mentoring Chrissy and Martina, she's no less relevant. If anything, she's more relevant now, which is, you know, extraordinary that she's kept herself that relevant. But it is such a shame to me that sense of responsibility has been lost, that somebody like Billie Jean King isn't being called upon in some sort of official capacity by the WTA to educate players in the history of the game, the context in which they're all playing the sport and earning the money that they are. It just seems like such an open goal being missed.
She would jump at it. Oh. She would jump at it. And actually, it was quite clear from the interview, so would Chrissy Evans.
Absolutely.
She doesn't want to impose herself. She was very clear about that. I also think she feels that if there is a request for it, it should come from the players themselves rather than having to put it on them. But that really struck me. And whenever I've seen, I saw that one Instagram Live she did with Tomljanovic and Berrettini, and it slightly wound me up how she's so generous with these young players. She's so sort of backing them, bigging them up. She does it on Twitter as well. I've noticed she really supports players. She really tries to give them a boost. And yet when you look at what they've achieved relative to what she's achieved, it's very generous of her, really, because they've done next to nothing compared to what she's done. And I do feel like it's something that could be utilized more. Her life experiences, her tennis experiences, and as you say, an education. Because I love the fact that she's got that total sense of responsibility about what was required for the game to prosper.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
I just got to read out another stat here from your notes, Matt. I've just been staring at this one for a while, and nobody said it yet. She won the 1976 US Open for the loss of just 12 games in the whole tournament. She won 72 games and lost 12. I mean, assuming she won 7 matches,
it was six.
14.
It was okay, 6 matches.
So she's lost 1 game per set on the way to the title on average. I mean, where did you feel unbeatable? I mean, yes. What can I say?
Yeah. It was 6-1, 6 love, 6 love, 6 love, 6-1, 6 love, 6-1, 6-2, 6-3, 6-1, 6-3, 6 love. That was her 1976 US Open.
Who got the 3-game sets?
That was Yvonne Goolagong in the final and Mima Jaušovec in the semi-finals.
Yes, who she beat in one of her French Open finals, didn't she? I think her most one-sided French Open final, she beat me. She very helpfully, when she referenced that when we were working together at the French Open last year, just called her Mima, which... which got me off the hook because I'd been rehearsing how to say her name, and I couldn't find anybody that could confirm that I was getting it right. So anyway, Mima.
And that was a US Open played on clay, and she's obviously best known for her record at the French Open. That is probably where her name comes up most often, the fact that she's won the 7 titles there. But what doesn't get talked about is she missed 6 French Opens to play world team tennis. So think how many she might have if she wasn't doing that. There's all, when you delve into it, these records actually get more extraordinary.
I'd love to hear more about that because, I mean, Billie Jean King started world team tennis. She's always been its biggest advocate, and it obviously clearly was a huge deal back then, less so now. It's still going, but I'd love to know what the thinking was there. You know, why would you not play the French Open when you are the dominant player back then? I mean, obviously, I guess it didn't have quite the same importance as it does now, or for a while, or team ten, you know, that's something I'd love to find out.
Were those in the had Martina emerged as a rival at that point in those years that she skipped the French Open, Matt?
Well, there was 2 at the start, which perhaps maybe Martina wasn't a rival then, sort of 71, 72. But then 76, 77, 78, she skipped, which was around the time that Martina was developing. Maybe Chris Evert was still dominating their rivalry in that stage, but Martina was a force. And as she mentioned in that interview with you, she knew Martina was going to be good before Martina started beating her. You know, she was aware of this was a threat coming. But yes, but certainly the end of her career, she played the French Open a lot more, and obviously still had a tremendous amount of success there. That never stopped. I mean, she had success everywhere. and she didn't really play the Australian Open that much.
No.
Obviously, this was very much back in the day where the Australian Open didn't have the same status or prestige as the other slams. So she only played it 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 times in her career, and won it twice.
Of course she did. So Matt's just got a section here on page 4, some Chris Evert quotes, and they're just so good, I just kind of want to read them out, including, losses are always a relief. They take a great burden off me. She didn't have many of them. Make me feel more normal. If I win several tournaments in a row, I get so confident I'm in a cloud. If I lose, I go back to the dressing room and I'm no better or worse than anyone else. A loss gets me eager again. I love the mentality.
Yeah, I mean, that is the mentality of a sort of superior competitive being to mere mortals, isn't it? I mean, I can't really relate to that at all. There's also another quote further down. She says on John Lloyd, the biggest difference between me and John is that I'm a competitor and he's not. I love that quote. I mean, yeah. You know, he was still a professional athlete, but by her standards, you know, she was the ultimate competitor.
He would admit that. I mean, he wanted to win and he had a good career. But I think the impression for me as a kid and the reading and the speaking to people that I've done is that John Lloyd was a really, really talented player who perhaps could have achieved more if he'd have had a slightly different outlook and mindset as a player back then.
Maybe he was too happy.
Maybe. Yeah, he always seems pretty happy.
he's a lovely bloke.
we know him quite well in sort of latter years, but it would have been so interesting to be around back then, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Yes, yeah. Would have been, yeah.
I mean, my childhood watching Chris Evert was mainly taken from early 80s Wimbledon, where really, I mean, there's an interesting dissection of her runs in the rivalry between her and Navratilova. And to me, it was always Navratilova was the superior player. But that was because I only got to see Wimbledon and she dominated the Wimbledon rivalry. And when you actually then go back and look at the swings within the rivalry, between 73 and 77, it was all Evert, 21, 4 lost. Between 78 and 82, Navratilova started to just about edge it, but it was still close. And then 82 to 85, it was Navratilova, 15 wins, 1 defeat. Now, that is the period that I would really remember having started to watch tennis, and that's how it felt. Whenever they would play, people used to talk very positively about Chris Evert as being a great champion, but it was always, there was always a little bit of, not past tense, but she was playing second fiddle to Navratilova, is how it was coming across through the British TV and media airwaves. And actually, the most interesting development of all of them for me is that between 85 and 88, she managed to get some wins again. And it was 10-6 Navratilova. But we talked about the French Open couple in a row, 85 and 86, that Evert won. And we watched one of them during Roland Garros relived. And I know that clay was more suited to her. And we've talked about her incredible record. But it also shows that the appetite she had for the sport, that she had a long career, and particularly by the standards of players back then, and just kept coming back for more. And I don't think that, given her public image, the way she was portrayed in the media, I don't think people really appreciated what a grinding competitor she was. That she, I mean, even take an individual rally as an example, but that then is shown throughout her entire career, that she just doesn't go away, keeps going.
And yeah, I think the fact that, I think I said this maybe in our Roland Garros pod, the fact that she went back and didn't completely reinvent herself as a tennis player, but made adjustments to improve, to be able to live with Martina Navratilova through that fourth period of their rivalry, as you've described, is an incredible achievement in her career, because she could have thought, oh, I'm Chris Evert, I've done it all, I've already won this, I don't need it anymore, I can pack it up. But no, she wanted to get back on an even keel with Navratilova and continue that incredible rivalry. And that point you make about her grit and her determination, I've always felt that whenever I've watched highlights of Chris Evert, I've never, this is going to sound like a terrible thing to say, but it's never that impressive, because it doesn't actually show you what made her so good just looking at highlights. You have to watch whole matches and look at her whole career to realize what she was doing out there, that relentlessness, that concentration, that intensity on every point, her attitude. That was what made her so good. Obviously, she had this baseline game that people didn't have initially, and she brought that into the sport. But really, it was an attitude thing. There was an incredible quote from, well, article on Sports Illustrated after she was named the Sports Woman of the Year in 1976. And the question really was, what makes her so great? It was the same question that we're grappling with now. And players were asked to rate the different elements of a player. Who's got the best forehand? And they said it was Marita Redondo. Who's got the best backhand? Yvonne Goolagong. Who's got the best volleys? Martina. Who's got the best serve? Virginia Wade. Who's got the best smash? Rosie Casals. But who's the best player? Chris Evert. And so it's kind of like, well, what made her the best player? And the answer is that, and I'm quoting Sports Illustrated here, there are players who are stronger than ever and more naturally talented athletes than ever and more explosive volleyers. But what Evert has more of, what makes her a champion who each year moves farther and farther beyond the reach of more mortal tennis players, is grit. She has true grit, character, mental tenacity. She's a clear thinker in a thoughtful game, and she never gives up. So while others are playing tennis, Evert has an unfair advantage by resorting to another game, some sort of mystical hybrid made up of one part backhand to nine parts concentration. And it's difficult to define, and it's difficult to go back and pinpoint through highlights and through footage that's, you know, as we've seen, there isn't such a great archive. But I'm sure that when you were living through that period, it was so obvious what made her so great. It just doesn't
translate as easily nowadays.
Because Martina's strength was something that was completely visible on the outside.
Exactly.
It was a physical strength. And this is a quote that I think I mentioned during that 85 French Open Relived pod. But Chris said once that, I'm sure she said it a few times, that people would come up to her and say, oh, I don't like that Martina. She's too tough. She's too strong. And she would laugh and say, I'm the tough one. I'm the hard one. Martina's a pussycat. Talk about judging a book by its cover. And Navratilova said, Evert was the marshmallow with a hard center inside. And I was the opposite. But, you know, we are a sort of appearance-led world, aren't we? And, you know, particularly when talking about women's sport.
Mm. And I actually think even if you fast forward to the current day, one of the things that I've – and I don't know Chris Evert at all. I've interviewed her a couple of times, but personally I only know her through you, Catherine. But when you work with her – the warmth she has shown you, given that, you know, you've not been around very long in those circles. And I mean, I think a lot of it is because of the good job you do, how professional you are and how good you are at it. But at the same time, she shows new people that the open arms, really. And I think it's great because it's not always like that with people who've done what she's done. And, you know, I'm really just impressed by her as a person.
Yeah, me too, because she's intimidating. You know, I find her intimidating. She's not one of those people that, you know, or, you know, they could be anyone. You can't, you know, Mats Wilander walks into a room and, you know, he could be the bloke next door. You know, she's not like that. She has a real aura. You know when she's walked into a room, but she also has this, as you say, this real warmth and a thirst for knowledge as well, and an interest in people and what's going on around her. And one of the things that I find most magnetic about her actually is her willingness to admit mistakes and to admit fault. That is something that, well, first of all, isn't necessarily easy for people that have achieved what she's achieved, people, you know, with, I'm sure, big egos, et cetera, et cetera. I'm sure that's a very difficult sort of state of mind to come to. But also, I don't know, for me, it feels like something that's going out of fashion these days, being willing to admit fault. Look at, you know, governments and leaders around the world. You know, everyone's talking about this being a time of learning and listening, et cetera. But I don't know, people... It feels to me like admitting mistakes is not something that people are particularly prepared or happy to do at the moment. I mean, even on Twitter recently, I've been so impressed with her response to the civil rights movement that's going on in the States and around the world. And just a minor example of what I've just been saying is she quote tweeted a statement by Venus Williams about the civil rights protest, and she commented very favorably on it, but she used the word articulate to describe Venus Williams' words, among other compliments, and she was intending to be entirely complimentary. A few people went back to her and sort of said, I know you mean well, but the use of the word articulate in these terms is perhaps not quite right. And actually somebody tweeted her with the link to an article all about, you know, various bits of language which have racial connotations that white people might not necessarily appreciate. And it focused on the use of the word articulate by white people to describe black people and why that's problematic. And it doesn't make white people that have used that. I've probably done that in the past. I'm sure I have. It doesn't make you a raging racist. It's just part of the learning about, you know, these systemic issues that that we're all talking about at the moment and supposed to be learning about. Anyway, and she very gracefully responded to that and said, I've read it and that's noted. Thank you.
I get it now, she said.
Yeah.
And I agree with you. I was sort of thinking so many people right there would just dig their heels mm-hmm. in and assume being right. And instead she's gone and looked it up.
Or be defensive and just say, no, yeah. I didn't mean it like that. And, you know, what the article is saying is it doesn't matter how you intended it.
Well, Tamani Kariol tweeted a passage that Chrissy Evert had written recently on Instagram about this, and I was just so taken by it. She said, I've been reflecting on our country's current events, which started with the brutal, savage murder of George Floyd. Along with tremendous sadness and anger, it made me feel shameful, guilty, and entitled. But words are cheap. I want so much to help, but I have no idea what to do except throw my glove into the ring. So I'm committed to doing just that. One, I am reading up on Black history. And she lists all the publications that she intends to read and the people she intends to read about in order to properly educate herself. And she says, two, I'm doing a gut check. I'm examining my conscience and checking if there are any underlying residual feelings of prejudice that were indoctrinated into my beliefs at a young age. There was an overwhelming amount of fear and discrimination in the 50s and 60s, and it is necessary to evaluate how I was personally blinded. This is good what is happening, the demonstrations, the protests, the screaming, the tensions, the pressure, and I hope it wakes up this country. And I just thought, again, it would be so easy for Chrissy Evert to just sit back, put a gesture of a black square where her social media posts would normally be and join the crowd. And that's, I'm not trying to criticize those that do that. Not everybody does know what to do. I understand that. But the fact that she is determined to find out and to self-examine, I love it, really. I just think she's a hugely impressive person. And it's been really something to kind of get to know her career. And you were talking about Matt's, you know, she's not a highlight reel player. But when you go back and you actually examine the times and watch the matches, you get used to the pace of the shot. She makes that joke, doesn't she, Catherine, with you when you say that you were going to go and watch the matches again. She says, what, are you going to have to speed it up? And we all laughed at that. But when you go back and you watch her matches, that ends up becoming irrelevant because your eyes adjust to the pace. You start to feel the time in which those shots were being played, and you start to see what it is she's doing to her opponents. And it's just been, it's been a real silver lining to this period of no tennis for me to discover properly people like Chrissy Evert.
Yeah, and just going back to what you said about her brilliant words there about the civil rights protests, it reminded me of a quote from Martina that Matt dug up, which was her saying a while back, even before it was okay to be gay friendly, Chris was gay friendly. I appreciated that so much and never forgot it. And, you know, there are many sort of touching elements about their rivalry, their friendship, their relationship. But, you know, that's such a significant founding of it all, isn't it? You can only imagine the landscape that Martina would have had to face when she came out publicly as gay in the early 80s. I think she was the first tennis player to do it. And just think about the fact that was probably about 35 years ago, and no male player has come out in that time. It's extraordinary. So to think that she had the support in the form of probably the person on tour that she respected the most is a really cockle warming thought.
Indeed. Anything else, folks, before we sign off for another episode?
Yeah, I mean about 17 other pages.
Should we just post the pages? Yeah. Forget the podcast.
It deserves to be published. they're highlighted for ease of navigation.
They are. How long did it take you, Matt?
A long time. I think it was a couple of days worth of work. I know we were, you know, the way these interviews work, you never quite know when they're going to be, and I think you'd pinpointed that it would be sometime next week, but I was panicking that what if Chris Evert said, all right, I'm ready to go. We needed, you know, we needed some preparation. So
we've taught him well, haven't we?
Speaking of preparation, at the time of that interview, I washed and dried my hair, which is not necessarily a sequence of events, which is happening that often. I put makeup on. I put a dress on. That sequence of events definitely hasn't happened in the past 3 months, because Chrissy had really wanted to do the interview on FaceTime so we could see one another. And I thought, if that's what she wants, that's what she's going to get. But I'll be darned if she sees my makeup-free face. Sat down pleased with myself that I looked vaguely respectable. And there she was in gym gear looking completely fabulous. Sort of one of the first things she said to me was, oh, I think everyone looks better without makeup. Which is a really great sentiment and one that I sort of generally agree with, except don't apply to myself. Certainly not on that day I didn't. But yeah, it was all that prep for nothing, unlike yours, Matt.
Have you unpacked the suitcase yet?
No, I have not.
Okay.
Because I've now got visions of it being in a museum somewhere, courtesy of Mary, and I don't want to deny the world a work of something else art. Tennis art.
Can I also just let everybody know what Catherine calls Matt's notes when he prepares them for her for a big interview or a day of broadcasting? She says, it's like he's given me a superpower, which I love.
Yeah. I love that too.
It really is.
That's a guaranteed way to get some more.
It's like playing a computer game with the cheat codes.
Oh, it gets better.
You know, when you used to play Mortal Kombat, with unlimited light, and somebody, you know, a friend of a friend told your brother about the code you could type in to get unlimited lives.
I don't think they had Mortal Kombat on the ZX Spectrum in 1982. Or on the Commodore Amiga. Or on the Atari ST.
My God.
I can keep going. In fact, there was even a computer called the BBC, which was just the most exciting bit about it was a keyboard that had one red key on it, and I never knew what that one did, and it was the only one that was red.
The ejector seat. Did you not even did you not even have a SNES?
I did press it, but what?
A SNES.
What's that?
Super Nintendo.
No. What do they have these days?
Matt's too young for a SNES, and you're too old for a SNES.
Right. What did you have, Matt?
I had an Xbox.
Oh, they still have those now.
Yeah.
God, that's not...
Well, they still have Nintendos now. I think it's Nintendo Switch, which actually is a sort of a step in the retro direction.
When I was a kid, they actually had to load the games on a cassette, and it would take at least half an hour until you could play the game from having started the computer up. Right.
Are you older than I thought you were, David? Have you been lying about your age? It sounds prehistoric.
This is not how I envisaged ending the Chris Evert story, but there we go. I thought I'd just give you a bit of personal retro action. So.
Right. Well, mission accomplished, David.
Yeah. So, look, we don't really know when we're going to be next on the tennis podcast. It could be tomorrow because events are happening within the sport. Lots being discussed about when tennis will return at Grand Slam level. As soon as we do get more info on that, we will come back to you with another edition of the tennis podcast. What we do know for sure is we'll be back next week with some of our memories of one of the tournaments closest to our heart, the Fever-Tree Championships at the Queen's Club, which was due to take place this coming week, but which, of course, like Wimbledon, is not taking place because of the coronavirus. And then we will be back in a couple of weeks' time time with daily editions of Wimbledon Relived. We've chosen our matches. We can't wait to get started. Matt's preparing our superpowers. We're preparing the archive footage to watch. And we'll be back with you again very soon.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.